It's Tuesday, April 30th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Donald Trump has violated gag orders, plural, orders. And for the first time, we can say a former president has been found guilty of a criminal offense. I mean, we could have said it before, but it would be inaccurate. Now it's accurate. His statements weren't, and he will pay the price, a hefty $9,000. Judge Merchan was reflective. Quote, while $1,000 may suffice in most instances to protect the dignity of the judicial system, it unfortunately will not achieve the desired result in those instances. Speaking of the sum of $1,000 per violation of gag order, $9,000 setback. For $9,000, you could get a 2011 Honda CR-V with 110,000 miles or a 2016 Honda Yaris hatchback with under 100,000 miles. The judge, though lamenting, did not want to give Donald Trump prison time, and that's probably good. But what would a conviction, even if it doesn't come with prison time, what effect might that have on Donald Trump's chances of election? Well, I've been of the belief that a conviction can't be good. In fact, I'm going to stake out a stronger position right here before you now. It will be somewhat bad. On Fox News Sunday, my old colleague Juan Williams was generally agreeing with me, but then he was rebutted by another panelist.
Democrats don't want to hear this. Sorry, Juan, but these trials are not going to move the needle in the election, I don't think. And it's not going to help Biden at all. There, you know, Quinnipiac poll in March showed that 55%, just what you were saying, Shannon, registered voters said a conviction would make no difference in how they voted for the presidential race.
Well, 55% of voters say they won't change, but 45% will. And by the way, when they say 55% voters say they're not changing their votes, you know, almost 50% of them, they will be voting against Donald Trump. But how will they change their votes? So I looked up the actual polls. What they're not telling you is that 12% of voters say they're more likely to vote for Trump if he's convicted. That, as you can imagine, is almost entirely Republicans, though 10% of independents say, yeah, I'm more likely to vote for him. But if you look at the less likely figures, yeah, 49% of Democrats say they're less likely. I think they're posturing, and we'll get to posturing, more posturing in a second. But 29% of independents said they'd be less likely, and 12% of Republicans. And that's the March poll. But wait a minute, that's the March poll. It is April. I have no idea why she's citing the old poll, because there's a new poll on that question out, more or less likely with a conviction. And the numbers have slipped a little, but 9% of Republicans say they'd be less likely to vote for Trump if he's criminally convicted, and 17% of independents say so. So it is weird. Oh, by the way, we should also note that more likely is gaining. It's gone from 12 to 15%. I guess he's doing a bang-up job in convincing people that their self-interests are best represented if their president is convicted of a criminal offense. Anyway, the independents, to their credit, are keen to say this shan't be affecting my vote, unlike the Republicans and Democrats who, you know, want to tell you how much they're more likely or less likely to vote for a guy they'd never vote for. Again, people are definitely posturing for pollsters. But also, two polls in a row now, 9 to 12% of conservatives and 17 to 29% of independents say their votes will be affected. Same poll. So we see that it could have an effect in a very close election. I think it could have maybe the deciding effect. But who knows? You know, Donald Trump understands these people a little more than I do. But I still think it's going to hurt him. Net, a bit. And maybe if he gets more gag orders, maybe that'll hurt too. I don't know. Maybe. Although, come on, give the guy a break. He's not made out of Toyota Yarises. You know what I'm saying? On the show today, divulge, divest. Of all your asks, is that the best? Analyzing a chant for content. But first, Emmanuel Acho is a former NFL player. He now hosts a very fiery and successful Fox Sports show. He is author of the best-selling books, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man and a Black Boy. Noah Tishby is also a best-selling author. She of Israel, a simple guide to the most misunderstood country on earth. She's also Israel's former special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and delegitimization. They have come together for a new book, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew, Emmanuel, Acho, and Noah Tishby up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Noah Tishby is a producer, an actor. She is also an author, the best-selling Israel, A Simple Guide to the Most Misunderstood Country on Earth. Okay, hold on to that. Emmanuel Acho is an author of Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Boy. He also wrote Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. That's not his day job. He's a commentator for Fox Sports One and a former NFL player. So this is like the beginning of The Odd Couple. What do these two people with nothing in common have to say? Well, what they did was they got together and have authored a really interesting new book called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew. Tishby is the Jew in question. Acho runs the Uncomfortable Conversations media empire, and they're both here. Hi, welcome to The Gist.
Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for having us.
Quite the open, Mike.
How'd you guys first get to know each other?
Great question. So after writing Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man and seeing not just the success it had with the New York Times, but more importantly, the success it had with our country at large, I said, you know what? It would behoove the world if marginalized communities might, they worked together, right? Like if rather than Black people fighting for Black people, Jewish people fighting for Jewish people, women fighting for women, why wouldn't Black people help fight with Jewish people and women help fight with Black people and Jewish people help fight with women and the LGBTQ plus community fight with one another and we fight for them as well? Mike, we oftentimes fight in silos and realizing that it doesn't maximize our progress fighting alone. It's best that we fight for unity together. And so there was no more ready and competent and intelligent and bold voice than Noah Tishby. And this was 2 years ago, mind you, not the Noah that everybody has come to know now. This was the Noah that several people knew then. And so reached out to Noah, and Noah, you can kind of run with it.
Yeah, so couldn't have been put better. So I have been doing this work, meaning fighting anti-Semitism, defending Israel, inspiring Jewish pride, explaining the Middle East to a lot of people in America for the better part of the last 15 years. In 2021, my book came out. It also did very well, and I started touring the country and the world with this book. And about a year and a half ago, I got this call from Emmanuel to write this book. He wanted to do the same thing that he did for the Black community, for the Jewish community. And I have to say, Emmanuel reached out to me at a time where the majority of non-Jews didn't notice what was happening. So at the time when he reached out to me, this was when the Jewish communities anxiety was already at like a 9 out of 10. Now it's at a 27, right? But at the time, you know, but at the time it was already coming to a boiling point because of all the anti-Semitic rhetorics and attacks and marginalization and campus riots and everything that was happening. But it was under the surface for the majority of the non-Jewish community. And people would look at us and be like, oh, you're just crying wolf. Who cares about what Kanye West is saying? He's insane. But he noticed it. And he saw the anti-Semitism rising in America, and he realized that something is happening, and he reached out to literally try and help, to try and understand and try and help. And he said to me, which is a moment that got into the book, he said, I want your community to know that relief is on the way. And I started crying, and I was very moved by that, because it's not often that somebody from outside of the Jewish community comes out, specifically the Black community in America now, that comes out and says, all right, I want to sit down. I want to understand your pain. I want to see your community. The Jewish community is perceived by a lot of people as affluent, as white, as not only not needing help, but literally turned into the oppressor, the colonialist, which is, it's another iteration of anti-Semitism, but we'll get to that later. But that was when Emmanuel reached out to me. I couldn't have said yes faster.
So Emmanuel, you had this intellectual property and it's very successful and you could lend it and point it in a lot of directions. And not only have I read the book, I watch your web series and I watch your Instagram and social media, and you do a lot of uncomfortable conversations with a lot of people. And in fact, you've had a lot of conversations between Black Americans and Black people, a distinction that's often lost, and maybe we'll get to that. But of all the groups facing hate and oppression, there were attacks on Asian people, the LGBTQ community is, of course, under attack and legislative threat in a lot of states. What about Judaism? Did it have something to do with, I'll use a highfalutin term, your positionality, you as a Black man, you as the son of Nigerian immigrants? Tell me about why specifically the Jews?
Mike, phenomenal question. Phenomenal question. I think that there are a lot of similarities between the two communities that have now been lost, and thus division has been found. A lot of similarities, Mike. First and foremost, if you just want to talk about the issues at large that are overseen in America, right? If you want to talk about how the perception of Africans coming to America via ships versus Eastern European Jews who may have come to America via ships, and the distinction in that arrival. If you want to talk about the pain that was being inflicted on my Jewish brothers and sisters by Black men, if you will, Kanye West, a Black man, Kyrie Irving, a Black man, Dave Chappelle, a Black man. And so now I'm like, yo, y'all making Black men like look completely insensitive. Like, y'all ain't doing a great favor here. And so in the midst of the pain, and I keep an ear to so many things, but in the midst of seeing the Noahs and my other friends, the Montanas and the Amy Schumers and all these different individuals, I was just like, maybe I, as a Black man, can try to act as a different representation. Just a different one. I'm not making myself better than, I'm not making myself lesser than, but let me just at least act as a different representation. And that is really why Noah and I, in the book, we talk about all of the similarities between the two communities. Noah eloquently and brilliantly says, it used to say no Blacks or Jews allowed. Like, that is how the signage used to read. Now, unfortunately for the Black community, we were kind of still excommunicated once the Jewish community was allowed in. And that is where some of the division has arose. So I'll leave it at that. But there's a lot more that we have in common than we have apart.
When you originally conceived of the project, it was to talk about maybe Kyrie Irving mainstreaming these theories or Kanye West, and let's asterisk or note that he probably has a lot of mental illness going on, though he also has whatever sentiments he has about ill-informed, however they are, about Jewish people. Fine. But it was one thing when what was in the air was this antipathy for a people based on their ethnicity or religion. Everyone, every decent American can say that that's wrong. Then it became sympathy for victims of terrorists, which every American recently said it was wrong when it happened to them. Now it has become a war. And the war has riven much of the Democratic Party, much of American society, much of the world. It's a different thing. It's related to a lot of the topics, but you didn't sign up for defending or talking about with clarity and precision and empathy. You didn't sign up for that during a very contested war. How has that changed, Emmanuel? How has that changed your approach or what you think of the overall project?
It made it much more urgent. I think Noah and I would both agree on that. It was already urgent, right? Noah and I agreed to do this book 2 years ago. And I hope every listener understands and sears into their mind, this was not a book that came to fruition after October 7th. Mm-hmm. Like, there are contracts to prove it. We agreed to do this book years ago after October 6th, 7th, and 8th. And I say all of those dates, and you'll know why in the book. After 6th, 7th, and 8th, it was just like the urgency, Mike. It really kicked up. And that's when Noah and I kicked things into high gear. Obviously, you mentioned my interview with the Palestinian. I will not jump the gun to use a figure of speech. But that almost brought the book to an end. That's the most exciting part of that of the book, is when Noah and I talk about how the book almost didn't happen because of all the tension that even occurred between Noah and I.
Tell me about that, Noah.
Well, again, I don't want to ruin it for people, but we both, Emmanuel and I, are very big on being authentic and open, and an open book. So when this happened, and I'll tell you in a second what happened, we decided to actually put it in the book. I was like, we're putting this in. And he goes, absolutely. And everybody that reads the book, which is coming out now, everybody that reads it tells us that is the best part of the book. This is when the book gets into like a real, raw, authentic, and very current moment that people go, ooh, like sitting at the edge of their seats. We actually were asked, like, how are you guys still friends after this? Mm-hmm. Like, for people who read the book. So it's a great moment. What happened was, and I'll do it quickly just because it's not that relevant, and you'll read about in the book, is basically a few days after October 7th, Emmanuel reached out to me and wanted to do Uncomfortable Conversations. And I said, sure. And then I said, you know, obviously, thank you. And then he said he's going to have some Palestinian expert on Gaza or something like that. And I said, sure, absolutely. Now, the fact that, and then it turned out that it was a specific woman who is, bless her heart, she is very extreme. She is
Nora Erekat's her name. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I don't intend to bring her into this, but her views are very supportive of, let's just say, resistance by all means necessary. I disagree, because I don't think that if you rape women and burn babies, that's resistance at all, specifically because there's nothing to resist, considering Hamas has been controlling Gaza since 2005. Israel's not even there. If the Palestinians would have wanted to create a flourishing Singapore there, they could have done that. But instead, Hamas chose to create a three-dimensional terror Singapore. So there's no resistance to, if you need to resist to someone, resist Hamas. So she's a very extreme person. She's not welcomed on a lot of mainstream news and organizations. She carries very extreme views, and she basically denies my right to exist. And I was very upset about that. And through the conversations that we had about this, this was so upsetting to me that it exploded. The conversations exploded, and we walked away from the book, and we decided to get to the other side. As I say in the book, and I say in life, the only way out is through. And I was like, we're like, screw that. We're sitting down. We're going to talk this thing through, and we're going to figure out how to have these conversations, because these are the kinds of conversations that Americans are having, that people are having at dinner tables all over America and the world. We're going to show how to have these conversations and how to walk through whatever it is that you need to walk through and get on the other side bigger, better, and more interesting for the reader, honestly.
Yeah. So when you look back on that conversation with, she's a professor at Georgetown and a Palestinian activist, and I watched the whole thing, and to me, it was, I've seen much more extreme declarations of support for Hamas, but I know what her point of view is. Do you critique yourself in any way for that original conversation that you had, Emmanuel?
You know, I heard this quote, and I'll use it now. If I would have changed anything, it would have changed everything. So I won't critique myself. I think the best thing that happened was Noah and I having that moment where we stepped away from the book. Because, Mike, and to everyone listening, that is real life.
Yeah.
And it is okay.
It's okay.
To have a sharp disagreement, not just a disagreement. Let me make that operative word is a sharp disagreement with someone who you care about. It is okay to see the same thing to some degree differently, but come back together for the sake of healing, for the sake of unity, for the sake of peace, for the sake of love, for the greater good. Everyone listening will disagree at some point in time with somebody they love, with somebody they care about, with somebody they respect. The difference isn't if you disagree. The difference is, do you let that disagreement divide you forever? And so I would never want to change how it happened, because the most powerful part of the book, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew, is Noah and I very vulnerably wearing on our sleeve the truth of that situation. So much so, Mike, if I can be very honest with you, haven't said this publicly in any conversation Noah and I have had, that was probably the hardest chapter to edit, because Noah was like, nope, I want to tell it like this. And I was like, nope, I want to tell it like that. Like, but I understood, wait, Noah, you have your truth and I have my truth. And the truth is somewhere in between. Noah experienced that very differently than I experienced that. And I experienced it very differently than she experienced it. And if I am being honest, that is a microcosm of the division in all of our world.
Yeah.
The Jewish community is experiencing things vastly different than the Palestinian community, the Black community vastly different than the white community, the male community vastly different than the female community. So can we still come together somehow, some way?
So no, I don't know. Maybe you have.
By the way, I couldn't agree more on that.
Except I know you don't agree with. I know there's a part of you jumping out of your skin saying, the truth is not somewhere in between. The distance between a truth and a lie is not the half of the truth. You're thinking about certain things that she said or maintains that are inaccurate. But what you have to do, I would assume, is put that aside for the greater goal of listening to people who you don't agree with, allowing people who are engaged with you to engage with others and not tell them how to.
It's very easy. It's very easy to put the line. It's actually very easy. Yes, there's your truth and my truth and their truth and this, blah, 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 but there is right and wrong. Okay. There
actually even is fact right and wrong. Not fact, I would say, but yeah.
There even fact and not fact, but there is right and wrong. And the way to divide this right now is very simple. Okay. Do you support jihadism or don't you? That's where we're at in the world. Okay. So, and I know it, Emmanuel doesn't. So it, you know, even though he was like, I wanted to feel the pain of the Palestinian side and represent that, which by the way, I say it in my first book, I'm pro-Israeli and I'm pro-Palestinian. These two things are not mutually exclusive at all. Right. But if you support jihadism, if you support, because, you know, you can see even this concept today of like, of every, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's like freedom fighter. And like Osama bin Laden had some really good points. No, he did not. You support jihadism. And you have to know what jihadism is in order to know that you don't support that. So I know where Emmanuel stands on that. I also understand why he wanted to give space to a Palestinian woman to me. And I still stand that a Palestinian woman or a person would have been great. Her, less so.
Yeah.
That's and it's fine to disagree on that. I know that on the fundamentals, we agree.
And I don't want to belabor this. I want to get to other things, but something you just said, I have to put to Emmanuel. You just said, Noah, I am pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. There was literally that question put to her, can you be both pro-Palestinian, pro-Israeli? And she denied the premise. Was that question in your mind because you were already working with Noah on this book, Emmanuel?
1,000%. But that's why I, as someone who is not Jewish, as someone who's not Noah, I think there's so much beauty to the conversation in the book, because I ask Noah a lot of questions that I believe Black people, that I believe people of color, that I believe Palestinians might on the surface disagree with. So I'm like, hey, let me get an answer. I have no, you know, I don't want to use that phrase. I'm just indifferent. Like, I just want to know. I'm just curious. And so the reason I ask that question to so many people is because I do believe there are people who don't believe that you can be both. Mm. So Noah says I am both. Noah, educate me. Elaborate on it. Tell me how it's possible.
Of course you can be both. The majority of Israelis are both. It's just that the activists in America tend to tell you that you can't. And the activists in America are the ones that are saying, that are denying Israel's right to exist because they were able to be convinced that Israel is a colonialist state that shouldn't exist, which is insanity on its own premise, right? That the Jews have no indigeneity in Israel, all that crazy stuff, right? So to them, the Jews come from Europe and therefore they need to go back to Europe, which is crazy. And to them, resistance by all means necessary. And at the end of the day, they support jihadism. Yesterday, I filmed a segment for Israeli media with an Iranian activist, a beautiful girl who is all over social media, Elika Lebon, and she's an attorney, and she rages against those activists. And she's like, you have no idea what you're supporting. We've been trying to tell you, the Iranian people, we've been trying to tell you for years that we need your help, that this regime is horrible. This regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran, are the ones that are sponsoring Hamas, that are sponsoring Hezbollah, that are literally wanting to, that you don't understand what they're after. And that's one of the things, because like, sadly, like, look, she actually told me about that and I loved it. She's like, she called him Kafia Karen. And Berkeley Becky, right? All these activists in America, they know what they're talking about. They don't. They actually don't. So, yeah. And I know that Emmanuel, even though he wants to give voice to those people, which I do too, but the line crosses at, you know, jihadism and like denying my right to exist.
And we will continue our conversation tomorrow with Emmanuel Acho and Noah Tishby. We'll get more comfortable with these uncomfortable conversations with a Jew. And now the spiel. The protesters at Columbia have taken over Hamilton Hall. This couldn't have been foreseen, except it could have by everyone. The issue of the Columbia protests, all protests, but let's just specifically talk about Columbia, sometimes boils down to the kind of easy answer of how much should the students be allowed to say and when should they be allowed to say it. The answer is you definitely should give the students wide latitude to voice their opinions. But when it comes to rule breaking that impinges on the rights or genuine not perceived safety of other members of the community, then the school has to intervene. So really, when you think about it, most of the debate about the Columbia student protests have been what is the correct tactic in limiting the protests if it comes to the point where you have to limit the protests. So I do think Emory, my alma mater, probably shouldn't have grabbed and dragged a professor of economics to the ground, although she was getting in the way of the arrest. I will go out on the limb and say that was excessive. But when it comes to Columbia, they wanted to shut down the encampment that was on the lawn for a while, an encampment that pushed Zionists out of their zone, and they were right to do so. How should they do that? Well, the answer is they needed to negotiate. Okay, now here's where we get to also actually an easy answer, not a tough answer, but an easy answer that's being elided in much of the discussion, which is, well, what are the forms of the negotiation? There is the carrot and there is the stick. Columbia was pretty clear about what the stick would be. You have to leave by a certain time or you'll be arrested, and we'll also punish you academically, which would probably mean more to many of these students than the, let's face it, clout building development of having an arrest for a righteous cause on your record. But now we come down to the carrot. What can we give to you? And here is where Columbia students made some reasonable demands, like, you just have to let us protest in a reasonable time and manner in the future. You have to not take any actions or sanctions against us for having protested. But also, and this is the big one, you have to divest. Divest is such a off-putting word. What does it mean to divest? I think when most people hear it, they say, oh my gosh, Columbia invests in Israel? Well, I can understand that. If Columbia is giving the Israeli Defense Forces funding, and they're using that to kill Palestinians, of course students are going to be upset about that, but that is not what's going on. Okay, if Columbia invests in Raytheon or weapons manufacturers, and those weapons are being used by the IDF to kill Palestinians, well, you can understand why pro-Palestinian protesters would demand that stop. And maybe Columbia should listen. Maybe they should. That's not the case. That's not the point. What's going on now is the divestment demands of the Columbia students are that the Columbia Endowment, and you have to also think that Columbia's actual direct purchasing cannot go to any company that does business with Israel. Well, what companies do business with Israel? Basically all the companies. On this document put forth by student protesters that lists all the holdings and all the companies that are in the crosshairs of their divestment demands, Microsoft, Amazon, Mitsubishi, Google/Alphabet, Hyundai, Caterpillar. And of course, it's not just the holdings of the investment arm of the school, the endowment. It is all the purchasing of the school. So I guess Columbia students will be demanding a school where they do not use Microsoft Word or Excel spreadsheets or whatever the Google equivalent is. Numbers? Is it numbers? I'm not that well versed on my spreadsheet terminology, but it doesn't matter because it's all got to go. Only Columbia says, well, of course it's not going to go. There are a number of reasons why. And it's not just digging their heels in the sand and being obstinate, although that's sort of the way that MSNBC portrays it.
The administration has announced that they came to no resolution. The school is still going to maintain their relationship with the state of Israel.
That was Antonia Hilton reporting from Columbia, refusing to divest. What did the words choosing not to or declining to invest have been more responsible? You can use those words if you're a broadcaster. PBS does it.
In the meantime, a number of schools, including Columbia, have said they will not divest from Israel.
Divestment as a goal, if you don't know exactly what the investment is, might seem reasonable and might hearken back to the righteous goals of not just the anti-apartheid movement, but previous times when Columbia itself has divested. They stopped a direct investment in stocks that own private prison. Well, that was easy. It was a direct investment. Also, there is a council at Columbia which decides whether they are going to invest or not invest, and they allow objections to appear before that council. But the first criteria for deciding to divest in something is there almost unanimous consensus? And they specifically point out it's not about a majority. It's not about the number of signatures on a petition. Our criteria is the call for divestment has to be unanimous or nearly unanimous. And that is not the case. And it should. That is a good criteria, in my opinion. Otherwise, not only do you open yourself up to every investment be gainsaid and protested, and they don't own this stock directly. It's not like during the apartheid era when Columbia invested in Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola did business in South Africa, so Columbia sold its Coca-Cola stock. That's straightforward. These investment vehicles are in fairly complex instruments that, say, bundle together investment-grade corporate bonds. It would be possible to disentangle these investments or just to get your money out and invest in something different. But what's that different thing? I mean, there's a lot of things you can invest in, but are there a lot of good, safe, multinational corporation type things? You can't invest in an index fund because an index fund would have Microsoft and Amazon and Alphabet in big shares. In fact, let's go through the market caps of the biggest companies in the world. Let's see if we can invest in them. Microsoft, no. Apple, that one maybe. NVIDIA, ooh, hot stock. But according to The Watch, which tracks the BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, NVIDIA is building a supercomputer with Israel. Google, we know no. Amazon, we know no. Meta platforms, quote, Meta has been censoring Palestinian, pro-Palestinian, and neutral content, which shows the reality of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, which started in October, according to the divestment sites. Berkshire Hathaway, seventh biggest company. All Berkshire Hathaway is a collection of smaller companies, including Amazon, Microsoft, others on this list. You know what you can invest in? By the way, Tesla's number 11. Don't want to invest there. Walmart's number 15th, 15th biggest company. But according to the list of who not to invest in, if you like the Palestinians, quote, Walmart was quick to pledge $1 million to Israeli victims and condemned Hamas. Well, that's it. And if that's not bad enough, according to The Watch, the BDS site. However, Walmart did not donate anything towards charities operating in Gaza for the victims of Israel's genocide. So if only they had not donated to Israel, maybe we'd do business with them. Visa's on the list. Oh, Visa's a research and development center in Israel. Procter & Gamble, the 19th biggest company. Procter & Gamble opened an R&D center in Tel Aviv, occupied Palestine. It's not occupied Palestine. So you know what's on the list? There is Taiwan Semiconductor. Apple does seem fine, but mostly pharmaceutical and petrochemical companies, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk. That's who Columbia's portfolio will be made up of if they adhere to all the calls of the divestment movement. But beyond the complication of not having good vehicles to invest in, besides drug companies and petrol companies, there's the inadvisability of the boycott on ethical grounds and procedural grounds. Columbia has been hit with demands for boycotts before. Sometimes they've agreed with those demands, and now they have an advisory committee on social responsible investing, which, for one thing, continues to screen out investments in private prisons, but also offers procedures for anyone who wants to demand that Columbia stop investing in things. There are three criteria. And the first criteria is there needs to be unanimity or clear consensus of opinion on what not to invest in. The private prisons, clear consensus. It's just simply not the case with the Israel question. And even though when they put it to student votes, divestment does pass with a majority, the procedure and the criteria is not a majority. The criteria is not that we have 1,000 or 2,000 alumni signatures on a change.org petition. The criteria is almost everyone in the Columbia community has to agree on it. Not the case. The current protesters do not like the criteria. Of course they don't like the criteria. They don't meet the criteria. It's doubtful they would satisfy other criteria, which I was impressed by. This advisory committee also says that divestment must be more viable and appropriate than ongoing communication and engagement with company management. In other words, instead of just pulling out the money to hurt the companies a little bit and Columbia a lot, why don't we ask the companies, hey, could you stop doing business in this way or with these particular units of the IDF, say? That's not going to work with Amazon. That's not going to work with Microsoft. The idea of dictating to the people who are tasked with overseeing Columbia's endowment that they should spend a lot of time and a lot of effort in ignoring the great majority of available investments to choose other less attractive investments to betray their fiduciary responsibility, to do essentially a cull of any hint of Amazon or Microsoft in companies that they might invest in, or investment vehicles, or bonds, or bond funds. You know what that will do? That will hurt Microsoft and Amazon nothing. That will hurt Israel maybe a little less than that, but that will rob the Columbia endowment of millions, tens of millions, that they otherwise would realize. And I know the Columbia students probably don't give a damn about the Columbia endowment, but maybe one day when they're alumni, if they're alumni, they will. And maybe if they were to step aside and say, oh, some of that goes to my scholarship, maybe they also would. And those tasked with overseeing the endowment, which is making Columbia the very rich, well-resourced university that all these students wanted to go to, betraying that because of the loudness of the outcry or the intensity of the moment or the cadence of the chanting. So the schools, I know, are in a position of not being able to match a very catchy chant with a more reality-based version. I mean, you could pass out the lyric sheets, but do you really think they're going to be walking around the quad chanting, disclose, divest? The first is fine, the last's in jest. But for the non-chant-based community, us, you and me, it should be made clear, this is no clarion call for justice. It's, what's the word that I keep coming back to? It's silly. The only thing that mitigates the difficulty of the implementation of the divestment ask is the deficiency of the result. Not a chant, just the truth. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. From me to you, Boo Prue, Jeep Prue, Do Purdue. Thanks for listening.